So I'd like to also start out by thanking Lorenza and Ivan for the invitation. It's always special for me to come back to Santa Barbara since I spent a significant fraction of my life or career here. So what I will do is I will tell you about a recent experiments that we have done where we have seen spin demonstrated spin photon entanglement using spins that are confined in semiconductor quantum dots. So the motivation for this kind of work comes from the desire to realize an efficient spin photon quantum interface. And what I mean by efficient, or what would make such an interface efficient, is if we have a nice narrow transform limited emission transition and the emitted photons are predominantly channeled into a zero phonon line. And another desirable feature is that is the possibility to embed these emitters in nanocavity or waveguide structures that would enhance the extraction efficiency. So so the type of structure that we have used is a relatively modest cavity structure, but I will tell you also at the end of the talk some future directions and also what kind of cavity structures might be suitable for enhancing the extraction efficiency. And I will also mention one potentially interesting quantum control issue that comes up when one tries to do a control using optical fields in these quantum dots. OK, so first I will start out by turning off internet, because this somehow disables me from having a true control over. So I will tell you first about quantum dots. Apologies for those who have already seen this kind of overview. So basically, the structures that we are using, or we have carried out these experiments on, are semiconductor islands that are embedded in a different higher band gap semiconductor. And the length scale is on the order of 10 nanometers. And if you're familiar with gate-defined quantum dots that Amir Jacoby or Charlie Marcus have been talking about, the difference here in these quantum dots is that the confinement is due to the differences in the band energies of the conduction and valence band between the semiconductor that forms the island and the neighboring semiconductor. So in our case, the island is made out of indium gallium arsenide, surrounded by gallium arsenide. And in this case, the conduction band energy is lower than that of gallium arsenide, and the valence band energy is higher, which means that on top of all these continuum of electronic states, the highest energy states are discretized in the valence band, and they're confined in this region where we have indium. And the same is true for the conduction band, that the lowest lying states are normally empty, but they are discrete. The motion of the electrons that we might excite here would be completely quantum confined before we reach the higher energy continuum states. And this is how these islands look like in a transmission electron microscope. And there is a more detailed structure, which is important for our ability to manipulate spin, but I will come back to that later as I describe to you the selection rules in the system. So very briefly, so to characterize these quantum dots, you will take some off-resonant laser field generating free electron hole pairs. Then these electrons and holes are captured by the quantum dot, relaxing relatively quickly to the lowest energy possible state of the corresponding band. So the electrons in the conduction band will fall in here, and the holes that we leave behind here are filled. Essentially, an electron drops down, leaving a hole in the highest energy valence band state. And from here on, there is recombination, and this results in nice sharp lines. And what I'd like to point out here is that the emission energy depends on the number of charges that are captured. So if in this process we were to capture an extra electron, the emission is shifted by about 5 milli electron volts. which is more than 1,000 times larger than the line width, which is a nice tool, sort of the first tool that we have to identify that we are dealing with the spin. That is, essentially, if you see that this emission line is different, that means, that tells us that we have an extra charge in the quantum dot. And that's an electron charge, because if you had a hole, the ship would have been in the other direction. And that is, in a sense, starting point for manipulating spins in this system. Now, after identifying the properties of the quantum dot, since each quantum dot is different, what we do is we turn off this off-resonant excitation and scan a laser through the resonance to find out how good the quantum dot really is in terms of its line width properties and so on. And when you do that, and these are all experiments done with single quantum dots, you see that actually as you tune your laser, you can get a very nice response, in this case, an extinction of the incoming laser field by about 12% from the quantum dot. And this number was initially surprising, but now we know that actually it could be much better. It could approach 50% if we could focus our laser beam closer to the diffraction limit that is determined by the high index material that we have. And nevertheless, we typically have these extinction ratios or absorption coefficients of about a few percent in our experiment. Now, what we could also do, instead of looking at the absorption profile, we can actually park the laser or tune the laser and look at the resonance fluorescence generated by the quantum dot. And for the type of experiments I'm going to tell you, these are the relevant experiments, since we will be looking at the quantum correlations between the state of the spin and the photon that is generated upon excitation of that spin. And we could also do sort of higher order photon correlation measurements, either using photoluminescence or resonance fluorescence. Now, so basically, now maybe it's coming a bit late, but this is roughly the sketch of the experiment. So we have a laser that we focus onto our sample, which sits in a dark cryostat inside a solenoid magnet. And so we either look at the transmission, so that we have a detector, so this is the dot sample, but we also have a detector right under that sample. So we either look at the transmitted intensity, and that's the absorption measurement I have shown you, or we collect the reflected light together with resonance fluorescence. We use a beam splitter to split it out. We use a polarizer to block the laser. So we basically use this trick that we send in laser that is, say, polarized at 45 degrees with respect to the dipole axis, and then set the polarizer to minus 45 degrees. That kills half of our photons, but kills the laser essentially completely. So we have an extinction ratio of about 1 part in 10 to the 7 for the reflected laser photons. And that means that all the photons that we see at this end are photons from the quantum dot, with a peak-to-background ratio that is more than 4 orders of magnitude. Okay, so, and this is absorption, and this is resonance fluorescence. So we typically have, in a second, about 2 million counts from the quantum dot. And as I said, this is not the optimal system. So brief summary of what has been achieved in the system, in other groups. So these results refer to experiments carried out in other groups. So basically, these quantum dots are extremely good single photon sources. So this is a pulse excitation, and you can see that the probability that two photons are generated is less than a percent. Now, in the same context, actually, by embedding quantum dots in specially designed photonic structures, people have, in particular Jean-Michel Gérard's group, have achieved photon extraction efficiency exceeding 80%. So this is basically saying that 80% of the photons that are generated are collected by your microscope objective. Of course, when you take into account the detector efficiency, the number comes down maybe by another factor of 2 or 3. And for us, this number is about 12-13%. And the other nice, interesting result from Metea Tature's group is that if you can also not look at the total resonance fluorescence, but only the Rayleigh scattering. And what they have shown is that what we know from textbooks, that the Rayleigh scattering is as coherent as the laser you use to drive the system. So in this way, they have single photons that have an extremely long coherence time. Okay, so now I'd like to sort of switch to the experiments, the spin photon quantum interface. Now, the first thing that I want to highlight is that if we want to study spin physics, we don't want these random charging events. We want to fix the charge inside the quantum dot. And that we do by using these Schottky diode structures. So we essentially grow the quantum dots on top of an electron gas, a degenerate electron gas, and then we have a top metal contact, and we make a ohmic contact to this end-off layer. In this way, we can apply a voltage and change the relative position of the Fermi energy, describing the degenerate electron gas, and that of the conduction band energy. So in this way, we can go from a neutral quantum dot to a dot that is deterministically charged, in which this electron would be in there because of, and a second electron cannot come in because of the large charging energy of the system, the Coulomb blockade effect. And this is our kind of photonic structure. So we have a DBR mirror underneath to make sure that the photons really go on top. And then we have a solid immersion lens that helps us focus better and collect better. Okay, so now I'm considering the case when I have this single excess electron, and that electron has to be accommodated in one of the two spin states. So the conduction band state for conduction band that are formed out of s orbitals of gallium and arsenide and indium, then spin is a good quantum number. So if the spin is, say, sitting in the lowest orbital spin down state, then what we will notice easily that if you do resonant excitation, a sigma plus laser will not be able to excite the system. So the only possibility to absorb a photon is that of a left-hand circular polarized photon, taking this electron from the three-house valence band state to the excited state. Now, in the excited state, then we have an electron singlet, and this electron singlet would in turn recombine by emitting, once again, a sigma minus polarized photon. So what I did not mention here is this particular structure in the valence band. So this arises, so basically, once you have an asymmetric confinement in a quantum dot, so you split the degeneracy between heavy and light hole states, which results in the fact that the highest energy states that are relevant for us are the heavy hole states. So these are states that are superpositions of px and py orbitals. They have a higher mass for motion along the growth direction, and that results in a smaller zero-point energy. And that's the reason why when we do an optical excitation, the lowest energy resonances are associated with these states. Okay, so we like to look at this in a simpler sort of quantum optics-like diagram. So the initial state of the system is designated by the state of the spin being up or down, and the excited states are these so-called trion states. And just as I told you, if I have a spin-up electron, then I will only talk to a sigma-plus polarized laser and emit a sigma-plus polarized photon. And in this way, I will have a quasi-recycling transition that many of you are familiar from trapped ions. So this is a scheme then one could use to measure the spin state by simple light scattering. So if you want to define a qubit in terms of the spin state, you can do some manipulation, and then you can turn this laser on and scatter photons. And if you apply a sigma plus laser and see photons, that means that the spin state is spin up. Now, this is in Faraday geometry, when the magnetic field is applied along the growth direction, that these selection rules apply. Now, there's something else I want to mention here. So another possibility is that we can take a laser, again circularly polarized, and detune it and apply on the quantum dot. So what would happen then is that we would not be scattering photons, but the effect of this laser would be to cause an AC Stark shift. But that AC Stark shift would only influence the spin-up state if the laser is sigma plus polarized. What that means is that for the spin degrees of freedom, we're generating an effective magnetic field. And this effective magnetic field can have easily strengths of several Tesla and can be turned on and off on timescales that are picoseconds. And this is the, in a sense, the basis of optical control of the spin, this possibility to apply magnetic fields that are essentially on for picosecond timescales. And this is something we will use in our experiments. Now, the experiments are not done in Faraday geometry. So we actually, to do spin photon entanglement, we rotate our sample. Our magnetic field is fixed. So we rotate the sample such that the magnetic field is not along the growth direction, but is perpendicular to it. Now, I won't go into the detail, but if you are in this regime, then the selection rules change drastically. Now, all four transitions are coupled, and there are definite selection rules for the polarization. So basically, the vertical transitions will be horizontally polarized, meaning that the light will be, the transition will be polarized along the magnetic field, and the diagonal transitions will be vertically polarized. And everything has, at least in principle, has equal oscillator strength. So then what you could do is that you can initialize your spin in the spin down state. I'll come to how we do that. And then apply a laser, ideally a pi pulse, even though we don't do that. Put the system into this trion state at an initial time. Now from that state, the system will decay, either emitting a red photon going down to the spin down state, or emitting a blue photon and going down to the spin up state. And unless you make a measurement, you would not know which of these paths have taken place, and therefore the resulting spin plus the emitted propagating photon will be in an entangled state of this form that I have shown you. And this is the basic idea behind the spin photon entanglement. But to be able to actually prepare the spin and eventually rotate the spin so as to be able to make measurements on the spin and in a rotated basis, we need an additional degree of freedom, and this is the quantum control, this effective field along the z direction that we can generate with an off-resonant laser field. So keep in mind that this laser that we use, so these energy scales we apply on the order of a Tesla field, 0.7, that means that the Larmor period is around 200 picoseconds. The duration of the laser is 4 picoseconds, and the strength of the field is much larger than 0.1 Tesla, so on the order of 10 Tesla, which means that essentially when we apply this off-resonant laser field, we can forget about the energy splitting here. This effective magnetic field will essentially couple these two spin states as if it is exactly on resonant. So how do we proceed then? So we have a pulse sequence for generating and initializing and measuring the spins. So it's the repetition rate is 13 nanoseconds, the period, but we can do this actually much faster. So basically, it consists of two long pulses. The first one is a 5-nanosecond pulse. So the idea behind this laser, which is applied on this red transition, is that if your spin is initially in spin down state, it does optical pumping to the spin up state, okay? And in doing so, it tells you whether prior to the application of this pulse, whether the spin was in spin down or not. Because if it's in spin down state, you will generate a photon, on average two. And if it's in spin up state, then you will not generate a photon. Actually, the situation is a bit different because of the low detection efficiency. But basically, we will always do spin pumping at the end of this 5 nanoseconds, meaning that at this point in time, the spin will be in spin-up state. Now, if we had seen a photon in this process during this 5-nanosecond time window, then we would know with essential 99% certainty that the spin prior to the pulse was in the spin-down state. If you don't see a photon, then we have essentially no information, because it might have been that the spin was in spin down state, but we did not manage to detect that photon, or the spin was in the opposite state. So it is this partial measurement, or this heralded measurement, that we use in this system. So anyway, after this pulse is over, the spin is in the spin up state. So we have prepared with 90% confidence level, the spin in the spin-up state. Then we apply a pi pulse to the spin that puts it back into the spin down state. So that is the role of the second, this short pulse that we apply. And at this point, we have prepared our spin. We come in with a nanosecond pulse that excites the system into the trion state. And at that point, we will be, as this guy decays, we will have a photon that would be entangled with the remaining spin. So that is the basic sort of cycle that we use. And then the idea would be the next 5 nanosecond pulse we could use to measure the spin state, whereas we would have to measure the photon generated here separately. So we would have to essentially synchronize our measurements such that we can we know which photon we are looking at. Okay, so this is the experimental setup. So we take the output now and divide it into two ports, one of them for the detection of the photon and the other one for the detection of the spin. So here we will have a spectrometer that will allow us to, computational basis measurements, allow us to determine what the color of the photon is. Okay, so I should also say that I refer to these as red and blue photons. They differ by essentially a few gigahertz in energy, so that there is really an exaggeration in terms. So, the important point, as I said, is the time-resolved fluorescence. So this is the pulse sequence that we apply, and this is the resonance fluorescence that we get. You can see that there is an initial pulse associated with this guy, and that is our spin measurement. We have some counts from this 4 picosecond laser. Because it's so strong, we cannot suppress it completely. But since it's occurring at a different time, we don't worry about it. And this is the photons that we are interested in for spin photon entanglement. And this is the resonance fluorescence spectrum as a function of frequency, showing you that there are indeed 4 peaks. They are not equal. And this is most likely due to nuclear spins influencing different transitions separately or differently. Okay, so now the experiment. So how do we measure the classical correlations between the spin and the photon? So in this case, again, this is the cycle that I have shown you. We might have a pi pulse. I will come to that. But without the pi pulse, we ran this sequence. And so first, we look at the unconditioned photon. So essentially, all the photons that are generated around this entanglement generation pulse. So, and then we frequency analyze them, and we see that the likelihood that we generate a red or a blue photon is identical, or more specifically, the line shape as well as the intensity of the red and blue photons that occur in these two different channels are identical to each other. And then the second question is, are we really generating a single photon? So that we can check using photon correlations. And indeed, what we see is that if you look at the whole pulse, then we have a modest G2 of 0 of about 0.15, meaning that there are some secondary photon generation events. But if we focus on a smaller time window immediately after the laser, then we can bring this down to 2%. So at that point, we have a very good single photon source. Of course, that comes at the expense of the efficiency. Then what we do is we look at the conditional detection event. So now, instead of looking at all photons generated by this entanglement generation pulse, we condition on the detection of a photon in this next measurement cycle. So as I said before, if I detect a photon there, that means that the spin prior to that pulse was in the spin down state. If it's spin down, then we expect the photon to be red colored. And indeed, if you do these conditional measurements, we see that we predominantly see red photons. Now, if we apply a pi pulse in between, then we rotate the spin before we measure it, meaning that if we detect a photon there, that tells us that the spin was in the spin up state, and then we have the blue photons dominating over the red photons. So that essentially tells us that our classical correlations are in order. So it's time to look at quantum correlations. So the way we do that is to apply a pi over 2 pulse. So for the spin measurement, this is relatively straightforward, which pi over 2 or 3 pi over 2, such that the measurement projects the spin into up plus down or up minus down. Now, So what we do in this case is that we remove our spectrometer. We remove all the information about the color that we had by using this spectrometer that selected out between the different colors. This is important because now we also want to project the photons into superposition of two different colors, right? So to be able to do that, we have to remove any possibility that we extract this information before the detector. And the second, we need to use a very fast detector that essentially projects the system into a superposition of the blue and the red photon. So when we do that, what we see is that there are oscillations in the conditional detection probability, and the oscillation period is not surprisingly given by the Larmor period. And the oscillations decay in amplitude because as the time between the detection, the generation of the photon and the spin measurement is increased, then we are susceptible to this T2 star process, spin decoherence induced by the nuclear spins. And this is precisely the envelope that we would expect to get, and a Gaussian decay of the oscillations in time, giving us about 1 nanosecond correlation time. And the conditional photon state upon detection of the spin is given by the superposition of the blue and red photons. Okay, and we can do this also in 3 pi over 2 pulse, and we see that then the two oscillations are out of phase. So this, we extract a total fidelity of about 0.67 for the spin photon entanglement. Now, where we want to go from here is to use this scheme to teleport a single photonic qubit onto a spin qubit. And the second step would be to generate entanglement between spins that are sitting in different cryostats, real distance spins. And for both of these steps, we need to be able to essentially do two photon interference from photons generated by different quantum dots. Now, the other interesting question that comes up that I alluded to earlier on is the role of hyperfine interactions in the system. So I did mention that these amplitudes were not equal to each other when we used a laser scan. So what I want to show you there is, you can say, something that one should have done earlier on. So we have a system, we know that there is some spin decoherence. To characterize that, the way to go is to do a Ramsey interferometry. So when we do Ramsey interferometry in the system, we see something rather surprising. So in this case, we would expect these sinusoidal oscillations decaying with the Gaussian amplitude in a time of 1 nanosecond. What we do instead see is one nice sinusoidal, then a non-sinusoidal, then a spike, and afterwards, no signal whatsoever. Okay, so this is telling us that nuclear spins, when we try to control the system by these optical pulses, we're actually not just talking to the electron, but we're also talking to the nuclear spins. And since nuclear spins have a long lifetime, even though the likelihood that we flip a spin is small, the effect is cumulative, and we, in the end, it influences the kind of measurements that we are trying to do. So this is something one needs to understand, and I understand it goes a bit beyond this paradigm of controls only affecting the system and not the reservoir. Now, just in the last 2 minutes, I want to show that we are actually indeed making some progress. So this is essentially interference of two photons generated by two different quantum dots in different cryostats. And basically by changing the, and these are photonic qubits, so superposition of red and blue states. And if we introduce a time delay, we will see we have some coincidence probability, and if they adjust this correctly, then we have about 80% visibility. And the very last word is how to sort of make these more efficient by having a better collection of the photons. So to this end, we are working with this hybrid semi-integrated structure together with Jakob Reichel. So in this case, the quantum dots sit on top of the DBR, but we just like before, but instead of having a solid immersion lens, we have a fiber whose end is coated as a curved mirror. And basically, we bring this fiber, we look around for the quantum dot, and whenever we find a quantum dot, we have a cavity around that guy. And in this way, we can, and if the wavelength, we can adjust by moving the system away. So in this way, we have a perfectly tunable system that comes with a compromise or reduction in the mode volume, but we nevertheless were able to show that we are at the onset of strong coupling. Basically, this dip is indicating a cooperativity of about 2. And last but not least, I want to thank the people who are involved, in particular, Weibo Gao, who is a fantastic experimentalist. Without him, this would not have been possible. Thank you.
Questions? OK, so I've got one to start off. Oh, Lorenzo, great.
Actually, I can make a comment. It's more of a possibility. I've been thinking a bit more about whether it is that when you control strongly a system, you really act back on the environment, as we were saying. There is actually an example in standard dynamical decoupling applied to an hyperfine coupled spin bath. And now that I think about it, what happens is like if, you know, our approach is perturbative, but if we go up to second or third order in Magnus expansion in perturbation theory, what can start to happen is like as a consequence of the fact that we do apply control pulses, there are what we call effective pure bath terms that gets generated, which means that even though we originally started with a system that had a fixed HB Hamiltonian for the bath, then other terms are generated as a consequence of the application of control. And those terms, we never studied, or at least I didn't study them in much detail because they seem to be far down in perturbation theory. But maybe that what you're approaching is a regime where this is happening as a consequence of the strong control or other kind of things.
I want to emphasize again that the rate at which such a control pulse or the sequence flips a nuclear spin is extremely small. So this is happening in millisecond time scales. Mm-hmm. But basically, from the perspective of nuclear spins, there is a nonlinear dynamics if you integrate out the electrons, and they have their own sort of stable points, and they approach over time scales of hundreds of milliseconds, these stable points, which in turn influence the electron spin. So it is a weak effect, but.
So it could be a high order in that sense, maybe. I don't know, it's just a thought. It's very interesting, of course.
So. How high?
In my case, it would be third order in Magnus. But the example I'm referring to, and it's not what Attach has, is. Well, we have to put in numbers to see in that case. But it's a slightly different, it's just a single spin coupled via hyperfine coupling to a quantum spin bath with dipolar interactions, subject to different kinds of, it was delta pulses, so it was a relatively old decoupling kind of thing, so.
Gershon, did you have a question? So maybe I'll ask my question now. So you were able to sort of, you know, create these wonderful superpositions between the blue and the red photons. Is there any possibility of actually engineering the spectral profile of either of those photons? Or both?
In a trivial way, yes. By coupling to a cavity, you can actually broaden the spectral profile because you would enhance the decay rate of the system. And typically, this will not create a difference between the two because the typical cavity line widths that we deal with are much broader than the splitting, which would mean that it will render both of these photons, both of these components broader. Any other possibility. I guess I haven't thought about it. I mean, it probably is, but the easiest thing to do is to just make the decay faster, and in this way broaden both of them identically.
Okay. Atash, is the motivation for doing this to ultimately have distributed entanglement between different quantum dots in the different regions and make a sort of entanglement network? And so what's the prospects for this, do you think?
Well, so I don't know if I want to comment on sort of what the prospects are for implementing this in a quantum repeater, right? But clearly the prospects for generating entanglement between two distant spins is very high. So I think that this is something we should be able to do in I don't know, maybe a year's time or so. So from there, how it goes, it's a bit open. Essentially, so the question is whether this would really, by using the dynamical control in a smart way to get rid of this T2 star decoherence, if it can prolong the coherence time, then maybe it could be interesting. Maybe there are other ways in which one can use these systems to, for example, do an interface with gated quantum dots. This is something actually we proposed with Misha some years ago. And in that way, sort of try to combine the best of both worlds. But there are serious difficulties in actually experimentally implementing such. No fundamental difficulties, but it really requires marrying different technologies, which is not always easy.
Okay, so I have another one. It's kind of related to Ivan's question. So, you know, we often think of using photons as information carriers or mediators and possibly to entangle things. It seems sort of important to be able to tailor the spectral profile of the atom. So I'm kind of linking my previous question to Ivan's question, because there's these sort of known results for two-level atoms. If you want to excite a two-level atom, then you need to have this exponentially rising envelope, so that it's essentially the time reverse solution of the decaying two-level atom. So it seems like a kind of important point. If you want to build a network, you need to be able to sort of tailor the spectral profiles of the light that's flying around.
So in this case, the approach that is more easily sort of thinkable or applicable would be the probabilistic entanglement generation, rather than sort of generating photons that can be captured. Right. But look, I mean, in that regard, so I can again go back to this result that I briefly mentioned. So if you do work with weak excitation and work with purely radio scattered photons, so you can actually adjust the shape of the photon as you will because it will simply follow that of the applied laser. So in this way, you can generate not short pulse, short single photon pulses, but let's say they will be 10 nanoseconds or so. But at that point, anything that you put in on your laser, provided that it doesn't have too high frequencies to generate incoherent response from the quantum dot, you would have the generated photons will directly follow what you put in. So in that case, those if you want to do coherent absorption type experiments, these will be the ones that are better suited.
More questions? Okay. Well, I think we've had a great discussion, so let's thank Atash.